Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, Ira Melman. After the shooting of an African-American by police near St. Louis, Missouri, there are renewed questions being asked about how police treat people of color across the United States.
We have to put a stop to police brutality. Our kids matter. Our black and Latino boys matter. We can't just shoot them down and pretend they have target practice because they're not.
Carolyn Weaver has the story from New York City. Some college and university administrators in the United States are asking questions about the way students are chosen to attend their institution.
All of the research tells us that while SAT scores and grades and transcripts do predict a lot of academic ability in college, they don't catch all of the potential in a high school student.
I'll talk with Jose Antonio Bowen about that. He is the president of Goucher College in Baltimore, Maryland. And George Pudich has the story of some new and unique ideas presented at a recent technology exposition, like a device that not only lets you watch your pet while away, but allows you to play with the pet as well.
Besides the camera, it also has a laser pointer inside, so you can actually play with your pet moving the laser from your smartphone. This is crazy fun.
All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. Last month's fatal shooting of an unarmed African-American teenager by a white police officer after a street confrontation in Ferguson, Missouri, has brought new attention to other allegations of excessive force and bias against racial minorities and poor communities. VOA's Carolyn Weaver has more from New York.
The killing of unarmed teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, is one of hundreds of police-involved deaths in the U.S. each year. Days after the Ferguson shooting, police in nearby St. Louis shot and killed Kajimi Powell, a mentally disturbed man who was holding a knife.
He got his gun out.
In New York, marchers protested the treatment of Eric Garner, who died in July after police used a chokehold on him while arresting him for a misdemeanor. An investigation is underway. Family members of two other black men killed in local police shootings recently appeared on a New York radio show, calling for the U.S. Justice Department to take action. Constance Malcolm's 18-year-old son, Ramarley Graham, was shot and killed in 2012 by a police officer who chased him into his grandmother's house. The officer reportedly said he fired when he thought he saw Graham reaching for a gun in his waistband. No gun was found. Malcolm has collected 33,000 signatures on a petition demanding action from federal prosecutors.
We have to put a stop to police brutality. Our kids matter. Our black and Latino boys matter. You can't just shoot them down and pretend they have target practice because they're not.
The FBI says local police departments report a total of about 400 justifiable killings by police per year. But the FBI does not verify the accuracy of the reports, and police killings considered unjustified are not included. An estimated 25% of those killed are African American, double their representation in the population.
We have been failed on a local level, and the only way that we are going to get any type of accountability now will be on a federal level.
Kenneth Chamberlain's father, retired Marine Kenneth Chamberlain Sr., lived alone in White Plains, New York, and suffered from heart disease. He was fearful and held a knife when police banged on his door after he accidentally triggered his medical alarm pendant.
I know I'm going to get hurt. Mr. Chamberlain, leave. I can't leave. We've got to check me out. Put the knife down.
Much of the 2011 incident was recorded by the medical alarm service and a camera on a police taser. Police refused Denise's offer to help calm her uncle. After an hour, they forced entry, tasered, and shot beanbags at Chamberlain, and then two live rounds.
And you can listen to it, and I've challenged anyone to listen to that audio and tell me that you don't come back with a fact-based conclusion that there was misconduct and murder.
Former police officer Eugene O'Donnell says that police are usually restrained, but most lack training for dealing with emotionally disturbed people.
When you send the police to a mental illness call, it is the worst possible thing you can do. Can't think of anything worse. Cops come with weapons. They're oriented towards force. They have to hold on to those weapons. They think worst case scenario.
A grand jury declined to return an indictment against the police officer who shot Kenneth Chamberlain. Chamberlain's son has filed a wrongful death suit and called for the Justice Department to finish the investigation it opened in 2012. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
For For some students looking to attend college in the United States, all that is needed is a two-minute video. That is the decision of Goucher College, a small liberal arts college in Baltimore, Maryland. The opening page of Goucher's website displays a photograph of a woman tearing up a high school transcript. I recently spoke with Goucher's president, Jose Antonio Bowen, about the reasons his school decided to make the change to its admission policy, as well as why the program is not available to all students.
All of the research tells us that while SAT scores and grades and transcripts do predict a lot of academic ability in college, they don't catch all of the potential in a high school student. So there are lots of kids who didn't do well on their SATs, like me, for example, who ended up being okay. So this is an alternative application. So students who want to apply through the Common App, send us the grades and transcripts, the normal, we still accept that. But we wanted to have a second process for people who might have good grades but who didn't think they totally represented who they wanted to be. So the idea is that you do a two-minute video. We're not looking for production value. We're very explicit about that. It can just be you talking in front of your cell phone. And you send us two pieces of high school work of which you are proud and want us to see. What they could be a science experiment. It could be a music recital. And one should be a writing sample. But that's the idea. That's all you have to do.
What is wrong with the current system that most schools are using? I'll just ask you to expand on this just a bit, if you don't mind.
Sure. I think actually most people, even the schools that use it, think that the college application process is broken. And while it does a good job of sorting students who are good at school into good schools, it also leaves lots of potential on the table. So we know, for example, you know, biologists, genetics, that talent is equally distributed, intelligence, like other things, should be equally apparent in all parts of the population. But the single biggest predictor of whether or not you'll graduate from college is poverty. It's your parental income. So that means that we can't be getting all of the potential into college. We know that tens of thousands of seniors a year who are academically terrific, who have great test scores and transcripts, apply to no liberal arts colleges like Goucher College. They don't apply any place. They don't apply to Harvard. They don't apply to Goucher. They might go to community college, or they might not go to college at all. So that's wasted talent. Those are people who are not going to college who should be going to college. And we need to have a way to have a conversation with more of those kids to encourage them to say, you can go to college. That's in the best interests of the country. And it's also in the best interest of Goucher College to have that conversation with more people.
But here comes the exception, and that is the majority of people listening to this broadcast throughout Asia and the rest of the world, that there is a problem accepting this from international students. Can you tell me about that?
Sure, and that's actually not a problem that I think that the college can solve. international students simply have to jump through more hoops. So we're currently working on how we can expand this for international students because it would allow, of course, allow you to demonstrate that you can communicate in English, which is essential for your success here at Goucher College. But at the moment, we wanted to keep this simple. We wanted to be able to say to make it an invitation to people to apply to Goucher. And so in America, we were able to say, all I need to do is verify your address and that you graduated from high school. So there's a little bit of information I need, and that process can happen. And for international students, the process is more complicated, and there are visas and all of that sort of thing. And so to be honest, we haven't yet figured out how to navigate all of that in a simple way. So we are very, very eager for international students. Goucher is one of only a handful of colleges, I think it's only one of two colleges in America, that require all students to study abroad, with the exception of international students. But that means that 100% of our students have an experience in another country. We are ranked number one in the U.S. News and World Report and the Princeton Review for our study abroad programs. And part of that is the internationalization of the campus. It's terribly important for our students to be surrounded by other people who've traveled, but also other people from other campuses. So we currently have 100 international students on campus. We'd love to double that. As soon as humanly possible, and I'm able to take video applications from overseas, we would do that. What I can say is that, we do accept all of the standard applications from overseas, and, you can do a video supplement. You know, we still have to have other verification of high school transcripts to do the visa work, and that's not my expertise, but that's my understanding, and we wanted to start with something that we knew would work and be simple.
Goucher College President Jose Antonio Bowen. For the first time, NASA, the U.S. space agency, has handed over the reins of one of its spacecraft to a group of ordinary people. As VOA's Roseanne Scherbel reports, the long-ago decommissioned 1970s-era satellite is finding new purpose on the planet in the hands of citizen scientists.
The International Sun-Earth Explorer 3 had a great run. Launched in 1978, the IC-3 studied space weather. It focused on gathering data about the streams of particles flowing from the sun. That solar wind can damage satellites, interrupt radio signals, and knock out electric systems that power our homes. In the early 1980s, IC-3 was the first spacecraft to fly through the tail of a comet, and a few years later, through the famed Halley's Comet. The probe was retired in 1997, and NASA set its course to fly by the moon in August 2014, and then forgot about it. Former NASA engineer Keith Cowing is the co-leader of the Reboot Project. With the go-ahead from NASA and funds gathered from a crowdsourcing website, he organized a team to try to take control of the craft and give it a new mission.
Every few years, somebody would, you know, listen to it just as an exercise to see how good their radio telescope was. So we knew, based on what people were hearing, because they were sort of listening as it was going to come by the Earth, we knew it was alive, because if we could hear it, that meant it had electricity, which meant its solar cells were working, and it had two transmitters. So that's kind of two of the most important things. You have power and talk to the spacecraft.
But IC-3 had no computer on board, so the Reboot Project turned to scientists who had built the satellite to engineer a 21st century fix.
We go through storage units to get documents that people had saved for 30 years. We found the commands, and we found people who could write software to recreate the hardware that had been thrown out. And it was sort of a mystery in reverse, going back in time and resurrecting. We call it techno-archaeology.
Cowing and his team built a new transmitter and installed it on the world's largest radio telescope at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico.
And we had to send tones to the spacecraft to tell it to do things, and we did that on the 29th of May. And we said, in essence, respond back, and it answered back. And then, okay, well, that's good. That was an accomplishment, because now we can tell it to do things. And we then sent some additional commands, and we eventually started telling it to do things, which, in essence, we were in command of the spacecraft.
But could the team get the propulsion system to work and direct IC-3 into a new Earth orbit, as they had hoped?
At first, we actually got the engines to fire to spin the spacecraft up a little bit, which everybody thought was impossible. But eventually, we reached a point where there was a problem with the fuel system, that there just wasn't enough gas to build up enough pressure to fire the engines. Everything else worked in the spacecraft. It flew by the moon about 14,000 kilometers away. We didn't really change its course all that much, but the difference is now it's sending back science to us.
Long after it ran out of fuel and its batteries died, Cowing says the solar cells kept the satellite working.
What we're seeing is we've been in space for half a century. We've gone from being able to do things close to shore, shall we say, to Earth. Now we've had stuff that's been out there for decades. And that's a different mindset now. We have to start thinking, how can we send probes out there that can last for half a century? And we've got one example of how you could do it.
IC-3 proved that its simple design worked. Cowing says the data is free and available online to anyone who wants to take a scientific journey with the rebooted probe. The satellite will not be this close to Earth again until 2029. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
The TechCrunch Exposition in San Francisco is a place where tech startup companies can meet potential backers for their new products. Under the banner Disrupt, inventors tried to convince investors their gadgets may be the next big thing. VOA's George Pudish is here in the cafe with a report.
Most of the gadgets showcased at this year's annual exhibition are designed to keep us connected and help us manage everyday chores. This headband, presented by the company named Melon, captures and graphically displays brain activity to help the wearer improve their concentration skills. Ari Barenhama is the co-founder and CEO of Melon.
And we're also showing off our mobile app, which is brain training games to help you train yourself to focus better and learn to focus better in day-to-day life.
Another startup called SmartPen tried to interest attendees to invest in its device, which replicates whatever you write or draw on paper and sends a copy to a computer or a tablet PC. Marketing director Catherine Hunt says it just takes putting a receiver on the top of the paper.
As you put the pen down, it sends out ultrasound and infrared to the receiver, which then calculates distance and position, and so it always knows where you are.
A simple webcam may be fine for monitoring your pet when you're away from home, but a gadget called PetCube allows you to interact with your cat or dog when you're not there. PetCube's CEO, Yaroslav Azhnyuk, explains.
Besides the camera, it also has a laser pointer inside. So you can actually play with your pet moon laser from your smartphone. This is crazy fun. And it also has a speaker and microphone, so you can actually communicate with your pet two ways.
Movpack co-founder Ivo Macado says students could look very cool moving around college campus on a personal transportation device that fits into a backpack.
It's also the world's first backpack and electric vehicle. So you can wear it in a bag. You can wheel it, and you can also just like with one movement, and you're ready to go. 15 miles per hour, 9 miles range, and it's great for commuters, great for students.
TechCrunch is a website focused on news about high-tech companies. Its annual exhibition attracts not only inventors, says East Coast editor John Biggs, but potential customers as well.
This is San Francisco, so everybody wants to try new stuff. So it's sort of like a big science fair for these guys.
Biggs says in spite of fierce competition, as much as 90% of the displayed gadgets will eventually find their way to the market. George Puttich, VOA News, Washington.
Like many cities, Washington, D.C. has a graffiti problem. Walls and the sides of buildings, especially in low-income neighborhoods, are often defaced by this illegal form of artistic expression. But as we hear from VOA's Julie Tabo, officials in the nation's capital have come up with an innovative program that uses the talents of local artists to beautify the city.
There you go. There you go.
About a dozen young artists have gathered at a workshop in downtown Washington to learn how to use spray paint to make graffiti that beautifies rather than defaces. Michelle Chen is one of the workshop participants.
So at first, you know, it seemed like a very sort of crude instrument, but just being able to see what artists are able to do with it, it's really amazing.
They practice on small walls with Eric Ricks, a graffiti artist from Liberia who used to paint on buildings illegally, but who's now getting paid by the city to share his talent with aspiring young artists.
It's one of those things I love to share and to see young people pick it up with the passion that I myself had, because I feel like I'm a big kid just as much as any one of them.
The workshop is part of a program called Murals DC that city officials have created to overcome their graffiti problem. After 10 weeks of training, most of the students, including Chen, join Ricks in a neighborhood in the north of the city to create a vibrant mural on a wall which was once defaced with graffiti.
And I guess being an immigrant, I have to say, man, I am truly living the American dream, because it's the only place I can think of that I've ever been that you could take something so off the cuff like graffiti and turn that into a something that you can live off.
After Ricks makes the initial sketch, his apprentices help him spray paint the colorful cloud-like formations that make up the background. They add shapes and words and distinct graffiti-style lettering, and then paint the images. The focal point of the mural is a close-up depiction of Rick's young daughter. The mural is just one of 50 the city has commissioned since the program began in 2007. Artist Aniakan Udofia recently completed his 8th mural for the city for a public aquatic center. Painted with aerosol spray as well as house paint in vivid blues and purples, it features a mermaid swimming through an underwater scene. The artist has taught a number of graffiti workshops, which he says has been a rewarding experience.
Instead of defacing property, what we do is I show them how they can collaborate with artists like myself and create something that not only they can get paid for, but they can also get praised for.
There is praise for the program from business owners like Sarbjeet Singh Kochar, who now has a colorful mural on the back wall of his store.
I think this is a beautiful contribution from my part for the community, that the clean building, nice artwork, and everybody's happy.
Ernesto Zelaya is a graffiti artist who, like Ricks, used to paint illegal graffiti, but is now paid to paint. He assisted Ricks on his latest mural.
It's nice to be out in the open to express myself, because I get to explode and just, you know, show a lot of emotion as well and just be who I am, I guess, you know.
And that's a feeling Ricks can relate to. His project, he says, is very close to his heart.
It represents words that I live by, that I think every community needs more of, and that's empathy, love, and of course passion, because without that you can't do anything.
Ricks plans to carry his passion on a journey across America, where he hopes to paint a mural in every state. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
An anti-monopoly crackdown involving foreign firms in China has caused concern within the U.S. business community. VOA's Ye Fan, in this report narrated by Colin Lovett, says it's not yet clear how the issue will play out in the coming months.
In recent months, China's government has investigated Microsoft, Qualcomm, Daimler, and a dozen Japanese auto parts manufacturers, and levied heavy fines, sparking concern that foreign firms are being targeted. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce alleges this violates the World Trade Organization agreement, and it intends to urge the U.S. government to file a complaint. The vice president of the Chamber's Center for Global Regulatory Cooperation, Sean Heather, told VOA this week companies that have drawn scrutiny from Chinese regulators have been pressured to admit guilt. A former researcher from the U.S. Business and Industry Council, Alan Tonelson, says the foreign companies in question have no realistic way of defending themselves in Chinese courts.
It would depend completely, not again on whether a certain statute or regulation in some technical term was violated, but it would depend completely on whether that foreign company could persuade the Chinese Communist Party that letting it off, that dropping its complaint would actually serve Chinese economic interests better than pursuing it.
The Chamber of Commerce report says discriminatory implementation of China's antitrust law is likely to violate the commitment Beijing made when it joined the World Trade Organization. But the president of the National Foreign Trade Council in Washington, William Reinsch, says a complaint is only likely if the United States thinks it can win.
If you look at the results of a lot of the cases, there's a tendency for the complaining party to win. And as I said, that's partly because people don't complain unless they've got a pretty good case. So if the U.S. does end up filing, I would be optimistic that they would win.
No countries have made similar appeals to the World Trade Organization. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang this week played down fears among multinational companies that Beijing's probes are targeting foreign companies, reassuring them that market access in China would be further eased. He emphasized that only about 10% of companies under investigation are foreign. In recent months, China's National Development and Reform Commission has also investigated domestic auto parts manufacturers and insurance companies. For Ye Fan, I'm Colin Lovett, VOA News.
That is all the time we have for this week's program. Our thanks, as always, to executive producer Bob Doty. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check our website at voanews.com, also our Facebook page at VOA American Cafe. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email from wherever you are to our studios in Washington, D.C. Email us at americancafe@voanews.com. And give us a telephone call. Dial the international code, then the number 1 for the United States, followed by 202-205-9942. When you hear the VOA ID, press 05 and then leave your question or your comment. For all the people here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll talk to you again next time on American Cafe.